Studio 360.
The heavy favorite for Best Actress in a Play at this year's Tony Awards, we're taping just before the ceremony, is Elaine May. She gave an astonishing performance in Kenneth Lonergan's The Waverly Gallery, playing a family matriarch getting Alzheimer's.
I've lost my purse! Oh, why is Ellen so angry at me? My keys? Did you find my keys? Oh, I can't find my keys!
Now 87, Elaine May has made a career out of astonishing people. It started in the 1950s as half of the great, smart, groundbreaking comedy duo Nichols and May.
Information.
Operator, give me the number, please, of George Kaplan.
That is Kaplan.
Mm-hmm, yes.
That is K as in knife.
Her partner, Mike Nichols, became very famous as a movie director starting in the 1960s with Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and The Graduate. But Elaine May became a movie director, too, which, if you don't know or if it slipped your mind, is understandable because 32 years ago, her reputation as a filmmaker was torpedoed. Studio 360's Evan Chung has the story.
There's a Far Side comic that showed up in newspapers in May 1987. Its title is Hell's Video Store. A devil works the checkout counter, which is near a pit of fire, and every video on every shelf is the same movie. Ishtar. This may be all you've ever heard about Ishtar, that it's a punchline.
Why would anybody want to sit through 12 hours of horrible movies? I could barely make it through Ishtar.
We could go back in time and avert major disasters.
What do you mean, like persuade Dustin Hoffman not to make Ishtar?
Let me tell you girls the three most important things I learned about life. Number one, hold fast to your friends. Number two, there's no such thing as security. And number three, don't go see Ishtar.
For comedy writers, Ishtar has been the flop that keeps on flopping. A notorious turkey, a critical catastrophe, one of the worst movies ever made.
This was a $44 million comedy that hardly made enough money to pay for its advertising, but I wouldn't have even objected to the budget so much if this movie had contained at least a few forlorn, funny moments, but it did not.
But if you dig deeper into the story of Ishtar, you'll find that it's a film that harbors a secret, which is that it's really good. And the treatment the movie and its brilliant writer and director Elaine May got was simply unjust. Okay, so what is this movie?
Ishtar is in the tradition of a buddy comedy.
Carrie Rickey was the longtime film critic at the Philadelphia Inquirer and is also a longtime Ishtar defender.
I found it funny then, and I find it even funnier and sometimes profound now. It's about the misadventure of two talentless singer-songwriters, played by Dustin Hoffman and Warren Beatty.
Telling the truth is a dangerous tunnel.
When you get out of that tunnel, you've got bitter herbs.
It's a black life ahead. Forget herb. I never heard of a hit that had the word herb in it.
And they both have bad voices and no rhythm with these songs that were so bad. I mean, hilariously, epically bad songs.
If you admit that you can play the accordion, no one will hire you in a rock and roll band.
And they get hired to sing in a country called Ishtar, which is, I guess, supposed to be Northern Africa, like Morocco or Tunisia or something.
I look to Mecca and I see the place where we live and the funny old dream.
Unbeknownst to each other, one of them gets in cahoots with the CIA and the other one gets in cahoots with the Arab revolutionary played by Isabella Gianni.
I am begging you to give me the chance to overthrow a tyrant.
And it's not going to go well.
What a smuck I was. Schmuck. It's not smuck. It's schmuck. Smuck.
There's obviously a gag of playing literally against their types.
Jonathan Rosenbaum is another film critic who's long supported Ishtar. He wrote for the Chicago Reader for over 20 years.
I mean, waking Warren Beatty, a person who's clueless when it comes to women, and Dustin Hoffman is the ladies' man.
You've got to give yourself a break. You've never been out with anyone but your wife.
Yeah, but you got to have the looks, Chuck. I mean, you walk into a place like that and the girls just want you. And the way you walk, you can only do that with a small body. Did you ever hear of a big sports car?
Elaine May modeled the characters off the road pictures of the 40s, where Bob Hope and Bing Crosby sing and dance through various exotic locales.
We're all on the road to Morocco.
Only in Ishtar, she made her characters talentless, flawed, and delusional.
She's looking at men in a very gimlet-eyed way. She really digs in deep about male vanity.
The only thing that Simon and Garfunkel or Bruce Springsteen or any of these guys have that we don't have is an agent.
You think so?
Dangerous business is as good as bridge over troubled water any day of the week. You think so?
You know, they're absolutely hopeless as songwriters and even as functioning individuals. And yet they're very lovable, I think. No matter how monstrous people are, and all of her characters in a way are monsters, she loves them all.
To people who have only seen masculinity presented as black and white, as in hero, villain, as in winner, loser. This is very shocking and nuanced.
It's something Elaine May has been doing since the brilliant beginning of her career.
Even though your stuff is truly abrasive, at the same time there's a warmth underneath it in a cockeyed way.
But I think that it's almost impossible to portray a character or do a scene unless you have sympathy with the character.
This is Elaine May talking to Studs Terkel in 1958.
Unless you sort of admit beforehand that you could very easily do the exact same thing.
Yeah.
And if you don't do that, then you have something that's sort of smart-alecky, if you'll excuse that. That's the best way I can sum it up.
She was being interviewed alongside her comedy partner, Mike Nichols. Nichols also would become an acclaimed director of movies like The Graduate. But already in the 50s, they were revolutionizing American comedy. First as part of the Compass Players in Chicago, which basically invented improv as we know it. And then as a duo, Nichols and May.
They became the particle physicists of improvisational comedy, kind of stripping down comedy to its atomic weight.
Arthur, you were supposed to call me last Friday.
Mother, darling, I just didn't have a second and I could cut my throat. I was so busy.
Arthur, I sat by that phone all day Friday.
They didn't have punchlines. The humor came from playing real, from showing relationships that anyone could recognize and identify with.
And your father said to me, Phyllis, eat something, you'll faint.
Darling,
I said, no, Harry, no. I don't want my mouth to be full when my son called.
Mom.
Everything changed then. It was no longer comedians doing golf jokes or take my wife jokes. They were reflecting on the human comedy.
So this was who made Ishtar, an empathetic comic genius. It had rich characters, funny songs. So why did nobody see it? Why did it lose an estimated $60 million? And why did it get this awful reputation?
I have a particular theory about what happened with Ishtar. It's something about the American character, I think. It seems to me clear, if you're looking at it now, it's quite clearly a satire about Reagan's politics in the period and America's politics.
It's a little rough right now because the communists are trying to instigate a coup against the Emir and take over Ishtar.
Why?
That's how it works. Ready to get Ishtar tomorrow to get North Africa?
Why?
That's how it works.
I mean, one thing Elaine May has said was that she wanted to say something to Reagan. So she thought, well, look, he's not going to pay attention to a movie unless it be a mainstream lowbrow comedy like the road movie. So why don't we make a road movie picture in which we get across the idea of what we think is idiotic about America's behavior in the Middle East?
And framed as that way, it's extremely funny. Two Americans astride a blind camel in the desert, which represents American policy in the Middle East.
What the hell's the matter with him? Is he blind?
Well, yeah, he is, but he's in perfect condition.
I think the reason why Ishtar rubs people the wrong way is it was saying something about America that was accurate, but the people didn't want to face or acknowledge.
So that's one theory. Reagan-era audiences didn't want to engage with its politics. But there's another theory about Ishtar's failure. And it's a juicy one. Sabotage.
I think we were barely 2 weeks or so into pre-production when the head of the studio, Guy McElwain, was fired.
Philip Schopper was the artistic consultant on Ishtar, basically Elaine May's right-hand man throughout the entire process.
And so that's not a good thing.
Because the new head of Columbia became a British producer named David Putnam. And this was bad news for the Ishtar team for three reasons. First, David Putnam was a crusader against movies with exorbitant budgets, like, say, Ishtar.
At that point, a $40 million comedy was unheard of.
Second, Putnam had a long-running feud with Warren Beatty from when Beatty's movie Reds and Putnam's movie Chariots of Fire were rivals for Best Picture.
David Putnam said that Warren Beatty should be spanked in public for making a movie as extravagant as Reds.
And third, Putnam also had a long-running feud with Dustin Hoffman.
They hated each other. So this is now the man who is in control of our movie, and we're still 6 months away from release to the public.
In other words, a guy with a public beef against the two stars of Ishtar and a philosophical objection to the existence of a movie like Ishtar was now overseeing Ishtar in the middle of production.
About 2 months before the movie came out, there was a very long feature in New York Magazine talking about all of Elaine May's eccentricities on set, and was full of anecdotes which made it seem like it was going to be the biggest bomb of all time.
The timing of this, not long after David Putnam came into power at Columbia, it smelled fishy to the Ishtar team.
The feeling was that a lot of these stories were instigated and put out there, if not thought up by Mr. Putnam, at least with his blessings, because he wanted to be the new regime, not the old regime that, you know, would finance a movie like Ishtar. It's almost as though he encouraged this movie to fail, to prove that his way of doing things is better than what these other people were doing before he came on board.
Now, it's very important for me to step in here and say that this is all unsubstantiated. There's no evidence that I can point to say that David Putnam leaked negative stories to the press to sabotage his studio's own movie. I reached out to David Putnam, but he declined to respond to the allegations. Now, looking at it from Elaine May's perspective, who, by the way, famously avoids all interviews, it is easy to see why she would be suspicious of studios, because she'd already had terrible experiences with them on her other films.
The problem she had was really just sort of like getting her own way in terms of having control over the film.
It started with the studio butchering her first film, A New Leaf, in 1971, which Elaine May wrote, directed, and starred in opposite Walter Matthau.
A New Leaf ran much longer than the studio wanted it, and they cut out an hour of it. It's still funny as hell.
Have you ever tasted Mogan David's extra heavy Malaga wine with soda and lime juice?
Not that I can recall.
It tastes a little like grape juice, and every year is good.
Why don't you just drink grape juice?
It's not as sweet.
The studio seemed to be happier with The Heartbreak Kid.
I just wanted to know how it felt to you.
It felt really terrific. It's just, I don't understand why I have to announce it all the time.
I have to be reassured. What's wrong with that?
It's difficult to give out bulletins in the heat of passion.
Great movie. Shocking movie.
But things got really bad with Mikey and Nikki in 1976, which is possibly her masterpiece. It's a gangster drama starring Peter Falk and John Cassavetes.
That doesn't scare you. To think that one day you'll die, be nothing.
Look, Nick, you want to visit your mother? Let's visit your mother, because the conversation is stupid.
It isn't stupid. It's interesting if you're going to die.
I'm not going to stand here at 1 o'clock in the morning and discuss what's going to happen to me when I die. I mean, that Michigas I leave to the Catholics.
The studio thought it was too long, too talky and too weird and too this.
They accused her of being a director who didn't know the word cut, who shot an unreasonable amount of footage.
I believe the number of feet she shot on Mikey and Nikki was three times the length of Gone with the Wind, which is an almost four-hour movie.
The studio took it out of her hands and made their own cut of the movie. And it flopped. Ishtar, a decade later, was her next film. And the crew had heard all these stories of this strange, difficult woman who couldn't finish a movie.
So that's what everybody is expecting. I think they are looking to fulfill their prophecies when they come to work on the movie. Oh, you know, she's crazy. So we're working for a crazy person. So this movie is bound to be crazy.
All the technicians, mostly male, were saying, I know how to shoot this. No, that shot's not going to work. It was constant on-set fighting.
Many of them were irritated at her directing style of shooting a lot of takes of the same scene.
She knows acting and she knows comedy and she knows when she's got it. So she will keep going until she gets it.
In someone like Fred Astaire, who demanded take after take of his numbers, it's called perfectionism.
But with someone like Elaine May, it's called being difficult.
I write a certain percentage of this off to Stone sexism. I mean, she was only, I believe, the third woman in the Directors Guild of America, the third studio director in Hollywood history. I think every day she had to fight to be heard. And I think what looked like oppositional behavior was probably a way of exercising control.
Because, you know, when a man does it, it just shows he's strong. If a woman does it, it seems to suggest she's spiteful and difficult. Like, how dare she do that, you know, where it's okay for somebody like a certified genius like Stanley Kubrick to do it, you know?
The New York Magazine cover story that came out in advance of the movie was filled with horror stories told by mostly anonymous crew members. So let's take one anecdote that was pointed to as a symbol of Elaine May's great folly.
Elaine May didn't like the way the desert looked, and so she wanted to change it. She wanted to move the dunes.
Supposedly, while filming in Morocco, Elaine May didn't care for the look of the Sahara with all of its big dunes. So in an act of hubris and wastefulness, she actually spent time and money flattening a huge area of the desert.
And that never happened. There's a scene in the film where Warren and Dustin are crawling along the desert floor.
Are those vultures?
Yeah. You faint? They thought you were dead.
You mean they're here on Spag?
But there are no sandy plains in the kind of desert that we were in. Where it was flat, it was hard, rocky ground. If they were crawling on dry, rocky ground, you'd be saying, did we cut to another country? Where are we now? And so we did move from some duny area, some sand, to cover what was probably 30 square yards. It wasn't like we made this huge football field worth of sandy. We just made an area large enough to be able to shoot the scene. And that was it.
Whatever the truth is, stories like this were spread as evidence for the kind of offensive wastefulness of Elaine May's production. And this is all before the movie came out.
I really think that the advance publicity killed it. The movie was hexed.
And then critics joined the pile-on. Almost every review, without fail, took a dig at how much Ishtar cost the studio.
Yeah, but why should we care what, you know, sort of like vulgar millionaires and billionaires do with their money, whether they get more money or lose more money? I mean, it's not as if it was our money that was being spent.
And the budget may not have been the only factor unrelated to the actual content of the movie that was affecting the reviews.
Warren Beatty had given the press a very hard time. I was present at a time when he publicly humiliated Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel at the Toronto Film Festival. He, well, diminished them and dissed them. So they had a chance to kind of get even with him, with Ishtar.
Okay, now let's have a roll of the drums, please, but imaginary drums, because this movie isn't good enough for real drums. I have saved the last spot on the program for the biggest bomb of 1987 or of almost any recent year. And you didn't think, did you, that we had forgotten Ishtar? No, you didn't think so.
The well was poisoned, and I don't think anyone could watch it with an open mind.
It's a movie that's hated without reason. It's just a snowballed sort of reputation.
Ishtar's reputation is finally starting to improve. It has big fans like Richard Linklater, Lena Dunham, Edgar Wright, Quentin Tarantino. Martin Scorsese calls it one of his all-time favorites. And that's all great, but a little too late. Because the real injustice isn't actually what happened to Ishtar. It's what it did to Elaine May's career.
I mean, it's pretty obvious that if that is this well-known flop, why have her make any other movies? Plus the additional reputation of sort of being difficult to work with and eccentric and a woman just, I think, put her aside.
Elaine May never directed a movie again, except for one made-for-TV documentary, which isn't to say she went away completely.
She is considered a genius scriptwriter and fixer. And God knows how many scripts she's doctored.
Tootsie, Reds, Dangerous Minds, The Birdcage, Primary Colors, Heaven Can Wait, and probably countless more screenplays we don't know about because she's almost never credited. But still, it's hard for me not to feel depressed that we only got four Elaine May movies, that we've been deprived of the voice of a genius for going on three decades, all for a supposedly bad movie that nobody actually bothered to see, as Elaine May put it herself in 2006.
If all of the people who hate Ishtar had seen it, I would be a rich woman today.
Remember that Far Side comic where the only movie you can rent in hell is Ishtar? Well, later on, in the introduction to a Far Side collection, the cartoonist Gary Larson confessed that he hadn't actually seen Ishtar when he drew the comic. Years later, I saw it on an airplane, Larson wrote, and was stunned at what was happening to me. I was actually being entertained. There are so many cartoons for which I should probably write an apology, but this is the only one which compels me to do so.
Let's put it this way. A movie like It's a Wonderful Life wasn't a huge success on release, and now it's a classic. I think sometimes contemporary critics are not always right, and Elaine May is usually a little ahead of her time.
Maybe in enough time, Ishtar will be seen as a classic. But I guess she knew what she was in for. Elaine May is a cinematic truth teller. And as they sing in Ishtar,
telling the truth can be dangerous business. Honest and popular don't go hand in hand. If you admit that you can play the accordion, no one will hire you in a rock and roll band. But we can sing.
Studio 360's Evan Chong produced our story.